This is Sundays with Jessica Norwood, and this is episode 2. Yes, 2. Episode 2. And you can find the show notes, articles associated with this particular episode, original artwork or art pieces that I've done inspired by the episode on my Medium page, which is associated with this podcast. Now, this is episode 2, and it is called The Weeping Time. And I'll tell you, I was not ready to write this particular one just yet. You know, if you can imagine that you're doing a conversation, a podcast about Black wealth, it's really easy to find yourself into the wealth that's accumulated through enslavement, through slavery. And I didn't really want to go there, but this particular podcast is about slavery, but there's also something really, really beautiful inside of this. There is this moment of, Black love that I thought was so beautiful and generous that I want you to hear. And, but I also want you to really key in on the policies that are made and the people who make those policies. Because I think we talk a lot about the importance of electoral work or so forth. And so I just wanted to talk about it. And this is the weeping time. And I'm not going to give it all away. I'm not going to do it. Stick around. And I think you will enjoy this one. Episode 2, The Weeping Time. I'm Jessica Norwood, and I'm a free Black girl with receipts. I'm a trailblazer in Black and social economic justice, and I'm an authentic curator of the culture. I am the queen mother, baby, and I manage the affairs of our hearts and our money. And this podcast is about Black wealth and the legacy of the racial wealth gap. You know, they say that wealth is where the past meets the present, which basically means that for Black wealth, it's where the legacy of racism lives on. For every dollar a white person has, a Black person has just 1 cent. Inside of that number is the untold story of Black economics in America. It's the story of how Black wealth tries to grow despite unimaginable deaths and lynch mobs. How Black wealth keeps trying to find the light at the end of the tunnel despite largely being cut out from policies like the New Deal and GI Bill. And Black wealth that tries to grow crookedly through areas of housing, education, and mass incarceration discrimination. These are the stories of what happens to Black wealth. You know, the racial wealth gap is pretty straightforward. White people have way more money than everyone else. And it's a fact that remains largely unaddressed. And it's a fact that has everything to do with racism. I approach this podcast the way that Maya Angelou taught me. She said, "I have a great respect for the past. And if you don't know where you've come from, you don't know where you're going." And thank you to our sponsors, RSF Social Finance and The Runway Project, where we are making patient loans to African-American businesses in the friends and family round, those kinds of rounds that matter and are impacted because of this racial wealth gap. Interior, kitchen, present day. Jessica's parents are overheard by the narrator. Her parents are standing in the kitchen, and her father is expecting that her mother would already be dressed, but she's not. She admits she had been speaking to Jessica. "I was just talking to Jessica about business." "Her business?" "Yes, well, I mean, my business too, and the businesses she works with." "You know, Black folks just don't get no break." "Right. We've done the impossible." "Yep." "We just hadn't had a straight shot." Silence. "Listen, I'm about to go up to Sarah Land and get your car washed off." "Okay." As he leaves. "Get dressed or we're going to be late." Her. Silent. So the piece you just heard was my original piece, and I decided to do this episode a little bit more like a play. So the first part you hear, I start off talking about interior, kitchen, and it's a conversation that happens between a family talking about their life and business and just how challenging it had been. And really, it's a sort of precursor to what it means to still be today trying to get through this particular issue. And so I break this particular podcast apart the way that they do acts and scenes in a play. So there are three significant moments inside of this podcast that I want you to notice. So this podcast, as you recall, is called The Weeping Time. The Weeping Time is the name colloquially given by the enslaved people who experienced the most horrific selling of their friends, their family, their loved ones in the largest slave auction that happens in 1859 in Savannah, Georgia. Now, the podcast does not start in 1859. We actually roll it all the way back 60 years to about 1800. In fact, it was actually January 2nd, 1800. And we roll it all the way back there because this point is when Reverend Absalom, who is a freed black man in Philadelphia, along with 71 other freed black people in Philadelphia, have written a petition to Congress asking them, begging them to end the slave trade. And particularly, they were concerned with and needed the abolishment of this fugitive bill, this fugitive slave law. So this particular podcast follows what happens legislatively and policy to the people as this particular conversation and bill weighs out over the span of 60 years. So that's where we're starting off right now. We're going to be talking about this Fugitive Slave Act over 60 years. January 2nd, 1800, Philadelphia. Reverend Absalom Jones and 71 people of color, free men, within the city and suburbs of Philadelphia submit a petition to Congress requesting protection from the oppression and violence which such a great number of their like of their color and their national descent are subjected. The petition focuses not only on slavery, but also the international slave trade. And a lesser known part that's not often discussed was the practice where all states would kidnap their brethren that are free and purchasing others as such a claim and property to them by slave speculators and by their agents. The petition further notes that the Constitution and the Fugitive Bill don't make a mention about black people or slaves. And so they assert that they ought to be able to use the rights and liberties guaranteed by the Declaration of the Bill of Rights. They say, "We feel ourselves bound from a sense of these blessings to continue our respective allotments and to lead honest and peaceful lives, rendering due submission to the law. And we are excited and encouraged to be agreeable and uniform and real friends to every denomination. Yet, while we feel impressed with grateful sensation and favors that we ourselves enjoy, we cannot be insensible to the conditions of our affected brethren, suffering, tender, curious circumstances in different parts of these states, deep in sympathizing with them. We are incited by a sense of social duty and humbly conceive ourselves authorized to address and petition to you on their behalf, believing them to be in common with ourselves, every other class of citizens within the United States, according to the preamble. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice
ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, and to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and prosperity do ordain. We apprehend this solemn compact has been violated by a trade carried on in clandestine manner and another equally wicked practiced by citizens in some of the southern states and even in the waters of Maryland and Delaware. Men who callously try to qualify for brutal purposes are kidnapping those of our brethren that are free, purchasing others as such a claim to property. These poor, helpless victims are settled like droves of cattle and seized, fettered, and trafficked. After a sufficient number is obtained, then they are forced to board vessels, crowded without the least commiseration, left to deplore the sad separation of their dearest ties in nature, husband from wife, parents from children. Thus, pocketed together, they are transported to Georgia and to other places where inhumanely exposed to sale. Can any commerce, trade, or transaction so detestably shock the feelings of man? Now, this is where it gets interesting because now you imagine this is Reverend Absalom Jones, and it is 71 freed black men, freed black people who are petitioning for the end of this fugitive slave bill in 1800. And they are also asking for the end of this international slave trade. And they're using the language of the bill of this Bill of Rights. And they go on and they say, your petitioners don't desire the enlarged volumes that might fill the sufferings of this gross abused class of human species. So they're saying that 700,000 are in unconditional bondage right now in the United States. And they are saying that the immediate immediate emancipation of all 700 of whom it said that's in bondage now, they know they can't get that. And they say that the degraded state would greatly disqualify such a change, but humbly desire you may exert every means in your power to undo the heavy burdens and prepare the way for the oppressed to go free, that every yoke may be broken. Now, this is the language that was submitted in the petition, and it goes to the House of Representatives, January 2nd, 1800. The House voted 85-1 to not even accept the petition. The one person who voted, you know, with seeing the petition, was a representative from Massachusetts. And he opposed the movement completely, but he voted because he wanted to give no encouragement to these petitions and to refuse them to ever consider because their tendency would create disquiet and jealousy. Scene two. Now it's 50 years later and we are at this point in history where Reverend Absalom and these freed blacks from Philadelphia in 1800 have already petitioned Congress. It is on record. It is there. They've petitioned Congress to end the fugitive slave laws. And at this point, we are now 50 years later. They were not interested, not doing it. And this is important. Congress is made up of more than just Southerners. And that vote, 85-1, really illustrated that this was something nationwide that was not going to happen. So 50 years passed, 50 years of nothing happening. So now we're back at this point, and I don't want to trivialize it and say nothing happened, but I want to get you to the point where the language specifically shows back up policy-wise at the national level, at the federal level, around this fugitive slave law. And it happens in conjunction with the Compromise of 1850. And so to give you some context about what's going on in 1850, the United States just finished the Mexican War, and the territory that is Mexico, that we now call United States, but there's this question of whether or not that territory should have slavery or not, and should it be declared free, or should the inhabitants, the people who live there, should they be allowed to choose for themselves? And California at this point has grown tremendously wealthy because of the gold rush of 1849, so just the year before. And they petitioned Congress to enter the Union as a free state. And the question really comes up, should that be allowed? Because ever since the Missouri Compromise, the balance between the slave states and the free states had pretty much been maintained. And any proposal that would threaten the balance of that probably would not win approval. And the other thing that's moving is that there is a dispute over land. Texas claim that its territory extends to Santa Fe, and finally there is Washington, D.C. Not only does the nation capital allow slavery, it's in fact the home of the largest slave market in the North America. So this is the context that's happening for this scene. It's January 29th, 1850, 50 years later. 70-year-old Clay, who is very well known for his work on the Missouri Compromise of Kentucky, presents what is now going to be known as the Compromise of 1850. Now, according to the compromise, Texas would relinquish the land in dispute, but in compensation be given $10 million, money that it would use to pay off debt to Mexico. Also, the territories of New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, and Utah would be organized without mention of slavery. And this has become something that they just say they can decide later on when they apply for statehood. Regarding Washington, the slave trade would be abolished in the District of Columbia, although you can keep your slaves. And finally, for California, they would be admitted as a free state. And to pacify the slave state politicians who would have objected to the imbalance created, they went and added another step. The Fugitive Slave Act passed. Now, of all the bills that made up the Compromise of 1850, it was the Fugitive Slave Act that was the most controversial. It required citizens, get this, citizens, everyday people, to assist in the recovery of those slaves. So if a person escaped, it would deputize overnight every person to hunt them down. Now, you don't know who it is. You don't know who's enslaved, who's not. There were free black people. There were people who had come to free states thinking that that was how they get their freedom. And this is the point where it doesn't even matter what state you go to at this point. You are always an enslaved person under this kind of law. So it denies the fugitive's right to a jury trial. Cases would instead be handled by special commissioners. Commissioners would be paid $5. And if an alleged fugitive were released, and $10 if he or she were sent away with the claimant. The act called for changes in filing for a claim, making the process easier for slave owners. And it also, according to the act, there would be more federal officials responsible for enforcing the law. For slaves attempting to build lives in the North, this really is a disaster. Many left their homes, and people don't talk about this, but this is how you get a large influx into Canada, because during the next 10 years, an estimated 20,000 blacks moved to Canada. And this, I think if you think of it this way, it really is the beginning of the terror of color, of the colored population. Like, you're not enslaved, but you're never free. And so this particular part, free blacks were captured and sent to the South, and there were no legal way to plead their cases. They were absolutely, absolutely defenseless. So this is what's going on in the country. We are 50 years from when Reverend Absalom Jones and the 71 Black people of Philadelphia have petitioned to end the Fugitive Slave Act. And at that point, it did not have the level of teeth that this version of it does. This version actually gets put into the United States Constitution. It passes, and it is a part of the Compromise of 1850. Scene 3, Savannah, Georgia. In 1859, one of the largest slave sales in U.S. history took place on the outskirts of Savannah, Georgia. 436 enslaved persons from the Butler plantations were sold in an event known and remembered as the Weeping Time. The Weeping Time was called this by the slaves and their descendants because that day the sky opened up. It poured down rain for the full 2 days of the auction. It was said that the heavens were weeping for the inhumanity that was being committed. Pierce Butler was the owner of the slaves sold that day. He inherited them from his grandfather, Major Pierce Butler. Major Butler was one of the largest slaveholders in the country at that time, and he was also one of the signers of the U.S. Constitution, a founding father. He was the author of the Fugitive Slave Act. When Major Butler died, most of his estate and holdings were passed on to Pierce Butler and his brother John, including two sprawling island plantations on the coast of South Georgia, one that produced rice and one cotton, and more than 900 slaves worked between the plantations. Pierce Butler regularly engaged in risky speculations and got a considerable amount of gambling debt over the years due to his compulsive card playing. It was these two factors that necessitated the appointment of a group of trustees who, in 1856, seized control of his financial assets in an effort to return him to solvency. Over the next few years, the trustees proceeded to sell off various Butler properties. In the mid-1800s, Butler brothers, Pierce and John, had what was then a fortune, about $700,000. Today, it's $20 million. The brothers loved the high life it afforded. For a costume ball, John Butler once had a steel suit made of armor, just for the occasion. It cost $500. Taking care of a slave for a year was $12. He never wore it again. And Pierce, he was addicted to gambling. Facing bankruptcy, Pierce Butler decided to cash his remaining assets. Over two rainy days in March, in 1859, with great fanfare, his estate held what amounted to be a liquidation sale. Pierce Butler sold 436 human beings. The Weeping Time, as it's come to be known, is the single largest sale of slaves in the nation's history. The slave sale was advertised continuously in the Savannah Republican and the Savannah Daily Morning News. It also ran all over the South. The Charleston Courier, Christian Index in Macon, Georgia, the Albany Patriot, Augusta Constitutionalist, Mobile Register, New Orleans Picayune, Memphis Appeal, Vicksburg Southern, Richmond Whig, everybody published. The sale was going to be hosted by Joseph Bryan, Savannah's largest and most notorious slave dealer. He had a virtual monopoly on the coastal Georgia slave trade. The advertisement that Brian published read, "For sale, long cotton and rice Negro. A gang of 460 Negroes accustomed to the culture of rice and provisions, among whom are good mechanics and house servants. They'll be sold on the 2nd and 3rd of March in Savannah by Joseph Bryan." Mortimer Thompson was a reporter for the New York Tribune. He traveled to Savannah and infiltrated the buyers, pretending to be interested in purchasing slaves. During the sale, Thompson made cautious bids to prevent from being discovered. And then he wrote and published what he had seen under the pseudonym Q.K. Philander Dostix. The eyewitness accounts of the sales are searing. Buyers pulled the slaves' mouths open, looked at their teeth, made them perform rudimentary exercises to assess agility. And in the case of women, they asked if they could still be bred. The auction was advertised for weeks. And on that day, March 2nd, the rain fell. For 4 days of prodding and inspection by prospective buyers, the slaves suffered through the sale. They stood stoically, attempting to keep their dignity, while buyers poked, pinched, fondled, looked in their mouths, insisted they bend over or extend their limbs or search for ruptures or defects. Pretend buyer Dostick, the reporter, recorded the facts of the sale, his observations of the emotional impact on the men and the women and children, including 30 babies, all sold for the sum of $303,000. Parents were separated from children, betrothed separated. There's one story that Dostix writes about a young enslaved man, Jeffrey, who was 23 years old, and he was pleading with his purchaser to also buy his beloved, Dorcas. He says, "I loves Dorcas, young massa. I loves her well and true, and she says she loves me, and I know she does. The good Lord knows I love her better than I loves anyone in the whole wide world. Never can love another woman half as well. Please buy Dorcas, massa. We'll be good servants to you as long as we live. We'll be married right soon. Dorcas, young massa, we loves each other a whole heap do. We really do." Realizing that his love alone would not impress his new massa, Jeffrey appealed to the purchaser's business sense and started marketing his bride in the desperate hope that they would stay together. "Young massa, Dorcas prime woman, A1 woman, see a tall girl, sir, long arm, strong, healthy, can do a heap of work in a day. She is one of the best rice hands in the whole plantation, worth $1,200, easy massa, and that's a bargain." What's evident? Jeffrey loves Dorcas. He loves her so much that he is even willing to include that should they have children, they'll also be available for the master. Jeffrey's new owner considered purchasing Dorcas, but he realized that she was to be sold in a family of four and couldn't be purchased independently. And when Jeffrey says that he finds out that he can't be with Dorcas, he walks away, grieving, consoled by a circle of friends. They were separated, ironically, because Pierce Butler had required that, to the extent possible, the enslaved be sold in families. The expressions on the faces of all who stepped on the auction block were always the same. They told about the anguish words could not say. Crushed hopes, blighted homes, broken hearts. This was a sad, sad, sad story. Some of them regarded the sale with perfect indifference, never making a motion, never saying a word, never looking at the buyer in the face. It didn't matter. On that day, the rain fell. The wind howled outside and through the open sides of the building. The driving rain came pouring, pouring, pouring in. In most cases, the slaves were sold as families, mother and 15-year-old, a 15-month-old baby, extended families, and whatever community they had on the Butler plantations, though, was destroyed. 436 people were sold over 2 days, went to plantations throughout the South, and little trace of them is known. But what we do know is that Pierce Butler made $303,000. That's about $8.4 million today. He gave many of the slaves a dollar, a freshly minted coin, and his white gloves, his dapper suit, before they were taken off to points unknown. And then he celebrated his windfall with bottles of champagne, paid for by Brian, the slave broker. Interior, kitchen, present day. Jessica's parents are overheard by the narrator. Her parents are standing in the kitchen, and her father is expecting that her mother would already be dressed, but she's not. She admits she had been speaking to Jessica. I was just talking to Jessica about business. Her business? Yes, well, I mean, my business too, and the businesses she works with. You know, black folks just don't get no break. Right, we've done the impossible. Yep. We just hadn't had a straight shot. Silence. Listen, I'm about to go up to Sarah Lynn and get your car washed off. Okay. As he leaves. Get dressed or we're going to be late. Her. Silent.
You have been listening to Sundays with Jessica Norwood, and I hope you enjoyed my little Sunday sermon. I appreciate you being here. You know, for me, when I was growing up, Sundays really did mean church. And it was there that I learned this ritual of listening and remembering. One Sunday morning, I asked my mama why we had to still listen to all of these stories from people from so long ago. I remember she looked down at me and she said, "Jessica, we do it to remind ourselves that there is no time like the present time to do the right thing." Do the right thing. That phrase still echoes in my mind because it taught me that we were not there on Sunday just to listen and just to remember. It was also about action. Do the right thing. The action that one takes of doing the right thing is what it means to be right, to live right, to do the right thing. And I remember her words And after she said it, the pastor stood right before the church at the close of service. Congregation was there, arms outstretched. And these big, heavy doors of the sanctuary swung open. And he said in this rich and rounded tone, "The doors of the church are open. Go out," the pastor would say, "with an open heart and an open mind." So I say to you, go out with an open heart and an open mind. Until we meet again, peace. Sundays with Jessica Norwood is an investigative arts podcast that tells the real stories of people, policies, and the scandals that shape the racial wealth gap, a gap that is so large that for every dollar that a white person has, a black person has just 1 cent. If you'd like to support this content and the content that I have on Facebook and other places, please go to my Patreon page and consider a monthly contribution. Any amount is, I'm sure, enough. You'll be billed that amount, whether it be $1 or $5, $15, whatever, at the beginning of the month, and you can cancel at any time. And when you send me something, I send you a little gift of thanks. Thank you.